Unpack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. It's the Top Chef Judges Roundtable podcast here on Reality TV Wrap-Ups. Hey, everybody. Mike Bloom here with an illustrious panel of ladies to break down this holiday episode of Top Chef Kentucky. I'm super excited about this. I feel full of holiday spirit and dessert, which means I'm going to be on a sugar high and promptly crash in the middle of this podcast. Let's bring in the panel to break it all down. First, making her 3-for-3 appearance here on the podcast this season, Haley Strong. Haley, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm glad that we're not starting recording this at midnight for a finish at 2:30 in the morning.
Yeah, we'd probably be whispering as quietly as the judges were this episode to not wake anybody up or, you know, talk about chefs that were in the next room too badly. I'm so excited to welcome back Emily Fox to the podcast. Emily, how are you?
I'm great, Mike. How are you?
Nobody's ever asked the question back this introduction. I feel so honored. Thank you. I hope everything's well with you and Josh. I'm assuming that he's been facing some sort of insurrection from PETA based on his dragon-based comments last week. So I hope everything's okay with him.
Yeah, no, he's doing well. He's doing well. We're actually mourning the death of our cat. So that's been a little bit of a bummer this week. But we just want to give a quick shout out to all the wonderful people who've sent us really lovely messages about him. He was a really old little 18-year-old man. But yeah, pushing through. Holiday spirit. Food to talk about. Very excited to be here. So thank you.
And we are so happy to be joined by a really unique perspective here, because I mean, this is a person that we've had on to fantastic guest in general, but I believe this is the first time we've had somebody on a podcast who not only, you know, has appeared on the show before, but has appeared on the episode that we're recapping before. So we can really get a firsthand perspective. She is the winner of Top Chef Charleston, runner up of Top Chef Seattle, all around fantastic person, Brooke Williamson. Welcome back to the roundtable. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I
feel like an a-hole.
This is my, yeah, Haley, very anti-Canadian, etiquette around you to ask me how I am now. That's okay. This is the best gift I could have ever received, to be quite honest. This is a great gift in general to have Brooke on to talk about this episode, because, I mean, you were in it until the wee hours to break down everything from this episode. Before we get into, you know, your experience with everything, how's everything been with you? It's been a little while since we talked. We talked with you last for the finale of Top Chef Colorado, where you talked about some of your experience there as well. But what's been going on in the life of Brooke Williamson for the past 7-9 months or so?
Ooh, wow, that's a long time to recap. I've done a little guest judging on Top Chef, which has been fun. I just remodeled one of my restaurants, Hudson House. We're about to hit our 10-year anniversary, so we felt like it needed a little bit of sprucing up, so we just reopened Hudson House. I don't even know when we spoke. I think this is the third time I've on this podcast, which is super exciting that apparently I did a good enough job to be invited back, which is super exciting. Lots of stuff going on. I've been a busy person, but very grateful for it. And Merry Christmas, you guys.
Yes.
Thank you.
And it actually feels appropriate because we're not recording this in May like you did the actual episode.
It was warm in May in Louisville.
Yeah, I was gonna say, considering that the last episode, I mean, one of the reasons Natalie went home is because it was so hot outside that her curd didn't set. Considering that the very next episode it's like, hey, Merry Christmas. I'm assuming a little bit of like a mental shift. I'm trying to remember, because I think, have you participated in a season where you've had those sort of holiday based challenges before? The one that comes to mind is that you did the Seven Fishes challenges, right? In Charleston.
We did do the Feast of Seven Fishes. We also had an episode that Nilu judged. It was a quick fire that Nilu judged, and we got like a secret box of ingredients that included quail and I can't remember what it had in it. But
I remember. For some reason, I remember Kurt at the time like scoffing at the fact that Emily didn't remember how to use a pressure cooker. That's like the only thing I remember from that quick fire.
Yes, exactly. Wow, you guys have like memories of elephants. It's insane.
White elephants?
Oh, great transition, Mike.
Thank you. Oh my God, Emily, I want you on every podcast now. This is so complimentary. But before we get into the actual episode itself, I actually do want to sort of touch upon the stuff going on from last week. First of all, I thought y'all had a really interesting discussion on the podcast about sort of how everything went down. But I thought we might as well take advantage of the fact that Brooke, a former chef testant, is on to sort of talk about the shopping process, because, you know, this whole situation with Eddie and the pork brought to mind some really interesting rules that might exist. And I was hoping, Brooke, you could clarify them for us and the listening audience.
Yes.
I saw this sort of like brought up online. When you're shopping and you go to the checkout counter, if something gets scanned, is there a chance that you can change your mind and get rid of it? Or is it like once you've scanned it, you've bought it?
No, once you've scanned it, you've purchased it. And that's for a lot of reasons. I think it's a Whole Foods reason, because for them to take stuff, I mean, it would just create a whole thing. But I think that just to make it fair and maybe slightly more dramatic, once you scan, you can't take it back. So on season 14, as vets versus rookies, I don't know if you remember, our first shop, the rookies had a really hard time because they had never done it before. And us sort of seasoned people who had shopped before in this type of a situation knew exactly what to do and put our most important ingredients on the conveyor belt first, like ingredients that we couldn't live without first. And I think that sometimes maybe later in the season, you'll start to notice people become more mindful of cost of ingredients and quantity of ingredients because of that cost. So I think that's honestly just like a first shop kind of situation where people kind of just don't know what to expect.
And then in terms of like the actual store itself, because Brendan Fitzpatrick over the week actually sent me a really interesting question. In terms of behind the scenes stuff, like, are you shopping at Whole Foods with other people? Are citizens just privy to the madness of 14 people running around for food?
Yeah, I mean, when we were shooting in Charleston, the whole city was very aware that Top Chef was being filmed at the time. There were sometimes people who would sit outside the supermarket and wait for us to show up because there was kind of just like one Whole Foods to go to. but I would say half the people in Whole Foods know exactly what's going on. And half the people are really put off by it. Like they're just trying to shop and they don't know what's going on. There are signs around the supermarket that say you are being filmed. Just be aware that you're being filmed. But usually when people ask what's going on, producers will just tell them like they're shooting a commercial for Whole Foods or something.
That is the best message to walk into any public location and just see like printed out, you're being filmed. It makes you feel, of course, the best way possible about your activities.
It didn't make us feel great about our activities.
So let's pick things up on that note of where we sort of left off here. And oh man, poor Eddie. Eddie's going to have a pickup at the end of this episode. And I will say, you know, I think as miffed as I personally was about the whole Natalie situation that happened last week, it does redeem me a bit to know that Eddie probably feels even worse than anybody on any reality show ever has felt about doing something accidentally. I mean, again, you were talking about him committing like seppuku last week, basically, and nearly falling on his own sword. Haley, what are you thinking about Eddie sort of dealing with the ramifications of his decision, especially since it coincided with the elimination of his Philly co-patriot in Natalie?
Like, I get how he feels. Like, I just understand that guilt. I feel guilty about like everything I've ever done, and I don't even know why. No, not Jewish, and I'm not Catholic, so I don't really get where this came from.
You're Canadian.
Yeah, you know what? That's it. I'm Canadian. We feel guilty about just existing. That's why we say sorry so often.
Well, actually,
what was the question? Oh, yeah. Eddie, I felt so bad for him because like that's exactly how I would feel. And I feel like I would probably let that affect me going through the whole competition and be like, oh, I ruined everything. You know, I ruined this poor woman's chance at winning and it's all my fault and I'm a ruiner and et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes I like to joke and call myself Failey because I have like that mentality sometimes. Wow.
I'm going to recommend that you don't ever do reality cooking competitions.
I'm going to recommend to myself that I don't do any type of reality competition whatsoever. I just think it would be damaging to me.
Especially since you've already created a hashtag for yourself for your haters to use. Did you ever like, you know, come up short on a competition?
Really?
Yeah.
So, and before this little, before we go to the quick fire, we also get a nice little bit here with Brian and Brandon and the dueling pompadours. Emily, last week you expressed yourself as an expert when it comes to pones. Are you an expert on pomps as well? Where are you on pomps?
I mean, the higher the better, right? I mean, it's really about getting that volume.
So I guess then I'll shoot it to you. Who do you think has the more dominant pompadour of the two?
I would have to say Brandon, I think.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah, because it has like a sleekness to it. There's not too much gel there. That's what I'm really concerned about with Brian.
I mean, that's true. He is getting a lot of open flame with a lot of product in his hair. So I would fear for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Brandon's a little just more like smoothly coiffed, I would say.
And Haley, I know you tweeted about this. You were ecstatic at the double confessional we got of the two.
Yeah, I love double confessionals. I appreciate that Top Chef does it every once in a while and doesn't overdo it. Like we saw a really great one with Bruce and Fatima last year, and that's when she was talking about going to the Taylor Swift concert when Bruce asked her if she's ever been to like a stadium football game.
Oh yeah. Now I remember that. Yeah, when they were working in the pairs. Brooke, do you remember? Did you ever do a cohabitated confessional with anybody in your two seasons?
No, and it was something that I always really wanted to do, and they never did them with my either of my seasons. I feel like we play off of each other really well as a cast, and I was always really bummed that I never got to do that.
Well, let's get into the kitchen here. There are Christmas decorations abound. Brooke, I'm going to ask the question that everyone has on their minds. Is that your sweater?
No, that's not my sweater. I mean, not that that would be strange for me to own a sweater like that. I do own several Christmas sweaters. However, no, we showed up with full on like wardrobe options, and the wardrobe stylist basically looked at us and said, you know what, I have something for you guys, and pulled out a few options. I did choose that sweater of the options because it lit up. Although I think the light bulbs were a little iffy, and I don't think it lit up on actual camera. And Richard chose the reindeer because I think it was the most subdued of the sweaters. I'm the opposite direction.
I loved that yours said, let's get lit on it. Like, big fan.
I was like, can I even wear this? And they kind of looked at me and they were like, well, I mean, we did order it for you. So
what a big holiday mood.
Yeah. And they also did just go to a bourbon distillery. So like, I think they're totally fine with just living in that mood.
And I was really bummed that Padma wasn't going to put on a sweater, but she was absolutely not going to put on a sweater.
No, she wore like a beautiful form fitting like dress instead.
They decorated her with some gold earrings.
Five golden earrings.
Brooke, I think it was like on your, I can't remember if it was on your Instagram or stories or on Twitter, but you had like a thing of you and Richard standing next to Padma being like, what did we do to deserve this?
I was like, oh, this is what happens when you come back to guest judge. They're like, just so you know, you will never be at this level.
You want me to stand beside a model and wear a weird sweater? Okay, sure. No problem.
If you even just look at the tone of her skin next to mine, it's really enlightening.
Literally, your skin is lightening as you stand next to Padma.
Yeah, they had to change the rest of the lighting around.
You really brought the holiday glow.
Oh, she's got this like cafe au lait sort of glamour glow, and I was like, can I just get some more blush, you guys? Like,
how did you feel when you know we see David really express some just admiration towards you both? Was that mood as like visual in the moment as it was when we got it on TV and in confessional?
Yeah, but it was really directed towards Richard. He really had
here. The love is directed towards you, so
yes, agreed.
I appreciate it. And Padma even showed me love and was like, you're talking to the quick fire queen. And I was very excited that she said that. But at the same time, no, he had his eyes fixed on Richard. That was all about Richard.
I feel like I need to ask this because now that you affirmed last season that you actually did know Bruce, did you know either personally or of any of these contestants before you came onto the show?
Zero, none at all. No.
Okay. So that's a nice, very like objective way for you to sort of look things over. Then you just see faces and names and just have to go with it. Go ahead.
No. Absolutely. It's a very different feeling walking into a situation where you know nothing about it. And I knew a couple of people on last season. I knew Richard. I knew Tanya. And I knew. I feel like I knew someone else. So yeah, but I really just knew them as people. And I knew what type of food that they cooked, but I had never seen them in competition mode.
Well, let's get into this quick fire. It seems pretty simple at the outset. In 30 minutes, make your best holiday dish, but you only get 2 minutes to shop for ingredients. At first I thought, wow, this is cruel. And then it got even crueler. I think The Office one time referred to Yankee Swap as Machiavelli meets Christmas, and I think we got that in full force here. Emily, what are your thoughts overall about the construct of this quickfire?
Well, I think it is definitely a pretty brutal strategy to just have everybody running all over the place, pulling as many ingredients as possible. I mean, Kevin pulling so much flour.
She's like, what are five you doing?
What is he doing with five?
Come on, man.
That's the best thing that has ever happened on this show. He's like, I don't know what happened. I have five kinds of flour and
what was going through his head? Was he just thinking flour over and over again?
He's like, I really want to make a specific starter and, you know, create a sourdough of 6 weeks from now.
I think he just panicked. I honestly, like, I can't even understand it. And I think he just got like fixated on one area of the kitchen and just couldn't stop.
Well, I think that my theory is that Kevin said, ooh, let me grab some flour, and then forgot he had flour and said, ooh, let me grab some flour. And that just kept repeating in a cycle about five different times. So we wound up with about 15 pounds of flour by the end of it, which I can only imagine what he would have produced. Like, honestly, just make a big ski mountain of flour at
right,
that
exactly.
point and have like hot dogs racing down it or something. Haley, what did you think about the ultimate decision to do the Yankee swap?
Oh my God, it was great. It was like great television. Like, it would suck for that to happen to you, but like for us, amazing.
Yeah, Brooke, how did you feel in the moment? I mean, did you have any knowledge beforehand that was going to be the big twist? And was that one of the moments where you said, like, glad it was them and not me?
I knew. I don't know. This kind of stuff is really fun to me. I could be put in the hardest situation and have to cook from very specific ingredients. I think you guys know me by now. I perform best when I have really specific constraints. And I looked at Kelsey's box, who was like, I think I got the worst box. And I was like, oh my God, I could think of six things I would have done with that. You know, like this is when my brain goes into overdrive and it's like fight or flight. And for some reason I fight in those scenarios. I was also really confused by it, just even as a judge, like I've never done a white elephant exchange. And I was so confused as to like what was going to happen next. And Richard knew exactly what was going on. So I was just kind of standing there watching.
I mean, it's essentially just the concept of making small children cry, at least in the Northeast from where I'm from. It's all about, you know, having a really bountiful amount of presence and then watching as the one thing you've had your eye on the entire time just gets taken away from you and you're too young to be playing this game. And then it really, you know, makes you upset. And, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm just talking about my childhood, but
it doesn't. Yeah, Emily and I are going really deep into our emotions today.
Yeah, we really are.
It's probably the, you know, the byproduct of having so many women on one podcast.
I know, guys, we're going to get on the same cycle soon. It's going to be crazy.
Well, I actually, it's so interesting.
Like, oh, God.
Well, moving on.
Pivot.
Well, the interesting thing, Emily, is that you bring it up, what your version of like Yankee Swap being for children, because I didn't have experience with it until the past couple years where like in my family now, all the kids have grown up to a point where like now we don't really give out individualized gifts. And now we've started institutionalizing white elephant, which I feel like makes more sense from an adult perspective, where you're sort of just like, I'm not expecting much. I'm expecting something random and wacky, rather than a kid hoping for that N64 only to lose it to like an oven mitt at the end of the day.
I mean, I don't think we ever had presents that were that. Yeah, no, no. It was like a nail polish kit or like a thing of chocolates or something like that. And like, I don't know. We used to go to a family friend's house, and a couple of the younger kids who really were too young to be playing started to cry and would get upset. So we had to, you know, kind of wait until everyone got old enough to do it again. But I don't know. There are a lot of awkward moments where we've tried to do this with Josh's family, my family and his. And my mom will start laughing at what she thinks is a gag gift. And Josh's mom will be like, oh, that was intentional. That wasn't supposed to be one of the gag gifts. So like we, you know, there's just a lot of like range of emotion that can come out of one of these things. And you just have to be really careful.
Wow. Because I was going to say this swap was awkward, but it sounds like you have undergone maybe more awkward swaps in your lifetime.
Yeah, I'm like strangely a connoisseur of this type of gift exchange. So
so it does seem like, you know, and the chefs admit that there might have been, you know, they got at the short end of the stick. You have David and I believe Nini did not get dip boxes that had protein. Kelsey gets Brian's, as you mentioned before, Brooke, which just is basically pig product, pine nuts and asparagus. And then, of course, poor Justin gets the box of flour, essentially, that Kevin gifted him. But to your point, Brooke, do you feel like this is sort of like a mini gauntlet as to the Top Chef tenet of you can make anything work if you're a good enough chef?
I mean, I don't know that about making anything work. I don't know what I would have done with 5 pounds of flour, but yeah, I mean, for the most part, I looked at all of these boxes and, you know, in retrospect, I feel like most of them I could have created a dish with. I don't know. It didn't seem that torturous to me, although I'm not the norm. So,
well, let's get into, you know, we get, you know, that people sort of thinking things through. Sarah's going to, we see people sort of pulling on, of course, like their unique background. Sarah pulls upon being the only Jewish kid in Kentucky. Nini talks about one of her first American Christmas parties. But let's get into the dishes proper. Haley, did any stand out for you in terms of the final products from the gift exchange, for good or for bad?
The leek carbonara just sounds really cool. Like, I don't think I would ever think to use leek as a pasta. Give me a strawberry ricotta hush puppy. I know it wasn't in the top, but that sounds really tasty.
That mystified me, just looking at those words and seeing it all come together. I don't know, Brooke, I know Michelle's was not really one that was spoken about, but did that stick out as much as it really stuck out from a verbal perspective?
God, it's hard to remember. I feel like there was a consistency issue. I feel like it was on the dry side, and it felt really dense. So in my opinion, a hush puppy should feel like a sort of cake donut. And I don't remember this having a texture or consistency that it should have, which I feel like is why it didn't stand out.
I figured it was just because it was from Michelle.
poor Michelle. We thought we'd get the standout with her, you know, grandmother being the
brouhaha. She didn't even get shown. No, she didn't even get shown in the Yankee swap component, did she?
No.
Yeah. She might just be like CGI'd in at this point. Are we sure that there weren't 14 contestants?
Are we the only
Michelle?
People seeing her? Is that what it is? Like, there's no one else?
Is this the girl? I mean, I know her name is Michelle, but is this who you've been talking about not getting any backstory?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, she's the one who we found out randomly last week that her grandmother was like the resident shaman of her Mexican village. But literally after that, we know nothing about her. She could be a ghost that is occupying the kitchen that just put on a coat and is trying to pass off as a human being. We're not entirely sure.
That's super funny because I just pulled up the cast on Bravo so I would make sure to like be able to place the face with the name. And I just looked at her headshot and I was like, I feel like she's actually on the show.
you were there, Brooke. Like,
Oh boy. Emily, did any of these final dishes stick out to you for any reason?
I loved Nini's take on the cream cheese and pepper jelly, just because that's something we do in my family and it is really delicious, but it is a totally random thing to eat. So I like that it got, you know, the play that it deserved, and I'm excited that it ended up being, you know, one of the top contenders.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about sort of the tops and the bottoms. And Brooke, maybe we can sort of try to reinvigorate your memories as to, you know, if you remember anything about these dishes in particular. So the bottoms are Eddie. Eddie tries to do this sort of like take on a stew slash curry. Justin completely tries to mold the flour into some sort of like meatloaf, and it ate too salty, a big theme of this episode. And Kelsey, I think that the general consensus was that she just could have done more. She pretty much like cubed the ham and put it on top of asparagus. Did you have any additional thoughts about those three dishes in the bottom?
Yeah. So, that curry was just like kind of a muddled, mushy situation with not a lot of flavor. When I looked at it, I felt like it was going to have a ton of flavor and it just didn't. I don't know if it was just under seasoning or just he didn't have enough time to, it was pretty, it was visually very pretty, to look at, but I didn't get flavor from it. The
meatloaf.
The meatloaf was so salty that I think the episode downplays how salty it even was. It was really, really salty. It was like every salty thing you can imagine put in, and there was just no balance to it. And then the asparagus, you know, strangely, the asparagus was actually very flavorful for being Christmas time, because it was May, you guys.
I was going to say the food fact came up that said like, oh, you know, asparagus is not a winter vegetable, but it's like, well, it actually works out well for the actual filming of it. Maybe not the airing of it.
It was May. Asparagus was great. And I feel like that could have been turned into a soup or a puree with like fried ham or I don't know. I felt like there was a lot that could have been done with that that just wasn't. And so that was the most frustrating dish to me because I just felt like it had so much potential and she just didn't see it from the moment that she opened the box. And she went in a direction that like she... You know, I mean, even the pine nuts could have like been turned into a puree. I don't know. That was frustrating for me. And then the fact that she called it bacon wrapped asparagus, and I get that she was giving us flavors of bacon wrapped asparagus, but it was the antithesis of bacon wrapped asparagus.
No, it was like bacon adjacent asparagus.
Yeah, it was just like asparagus with ham, and it wasn't terrible. It just wasn't like a dish.
Mm hmm. I also like Justin. Again, Justin's sort of like a master of quips, and I just love when Pam was like, you know, how did you feel about Kevin's box? He just goes, I was and still am confused about Kevin's box.
Also, the fact that nobody recognizes how much of a sexual innuendo that entire quickfire was, and they were just like throwing these box analogies out left and right, and nobody was recognizing it.
Listen, if Let's Get Lit got past the censors, I guess they sort of said anything goes here.
I guess.
Well, let's talk about some of the tops here, some that you and Richard and Padma liked out of all of them. We have Sarah's chopped liver, which, as a Jew, we have chopped liver at literally every family occasion that we can, so it spoke closely to me. We have Nini, Emily mentioned before, her sort of take on with the chutney and the nut with the homemade chips. But the winner ends up being David with his impasta leek carbonara. I am super intrigued to hear, Brooke, about how this actually ended up tasting.
Specifically the leek carbonara?
Yeah, because it seems like, because I feel like that's also a very like Richard-like thing of, ooh, it looks like one thing, but it tastes like another thing.
It was so good. I was so impressed by it. We were both super impressed by it. It came to us, we honestly thought it was pasta. And then we kind of twirled our forks and picked it up and realized it was leeks, and it was brilliant. It was far and away the best of all of them. It wasn't even really like a discussion of who's going to win this. It was like who should be mentioned, and obviously the leek carbonara is going to win.
Emily, we now see David win two quickfires in a row. He is sort of deemed himself the Quickfire Prince, or at least occupying the Quickfire Royal Court. Do we think that we're starting to see David's star rise a bit, considering this is his second Quickfire he's run in a row?
Yeah, I think we could say that. The thing that I really love about what David's done so far is he's been really killing it with vegetables. And that's not something that's easy to do, nor typical in a lot of the wins that we, you know, see on a regular basis. So the fact that he's consistently created things where you're like, oh, I don't know, man, you're going to make like a soup and you're going to think that this is going to beat everybody. And then it does, right? It just shows, I think, his technique and creativity a lot. And that's the kind of thing that people like to see. You know, the fact that leek carbonara, like, I can't even eat that because it has egg in it. But like, for me, I was like, that's something I would like to recreate. I want to make that, you know?
Absolutely. So the chefs end up sort of coming back together. They think they're going home for a special surprise. And it turns out that it is a full dinner with not only all the judges there, Brooke included, but also guest judge for this episode, Eric Repair, who has appeared many a time on Top Chef before. Haley, are you a big Eric Repair stan?
No. Everyone was like, oh my God, Eric Repair. And I was like, cool. He must seem great.
Very lukewarm on Eric Repair from Haley Strong.
No, like it's not lukewarm. It's like, I'm so sorry, but I would say French cookery was not a part of my 12 years of French classes through elementary school to university. I just didn't know who he was. I'm sorry, everyone.
Really?
I'm sorry. Please don't judge me.
Just say that you're Canadian again. And I don't know.
Canadian, guys, like, what do you want from me?
Well, Emily, I was going to ask, you know, Eric is huge in the New York scene. What are your feelings about him just as a chef in general? And I guess cooking mentor.
He just seems like a really lovely guy from every sort of iteration I've seen him on, you know, TV show after TV show. I've read about, you know, how he's a Buddhist. I'd like to give him a hug. That's kind of how I feel about him.
And Brooke, I'm trying to remember, did Eric, I'm assuming Eric must have judged at least one challenge you participated in, right?
No, he never judged. I don't think he judged one episode on season 10 or season 14. But he is a really lovely man. And I will say,
I'm so happy to hear that.
And really personable. I think he comes off that way on TV, but to the extent where, like, I felt like I knew him because I just feel like I know him, not only from watching him on TV, but from just his career and legacy. But we introduced ourselves to each other and then like continued on to like an hour there. You know, there's a lot of downtime sort of behind the scenes. And you know, as a contestant, you don't actually get to converse with the judges. And as a guest judge, you know, we're all hanging out in the same room during these downtimes and cooks and preps. We just sat down and conversed for hours. And he's just so relatable and personable and lovely to talk to. So it was a really great experience to just even for me to get to know him.
What was the experience like in general of going to this dinner? Because I mean, it also was, you know, it was seemed like a long day, went until the wee hours of the morning. But what was the opportunity like to actually go there and, you know, sit down and simultaneously also watch these people freak out? I mean, actually, now that I think about it, this is not too dissimilar a challenge from the Quickfire you did last season where you walked into the house and they all had to cook breakfast in there as well.
Yeah, I guess I seem to scream, let's judge a home cook. different in the sense that they were being blindsided in very different ways. This felt a little cruel, and it had been a really long day. I think my morning call time that morning was incredibly early, and then, you know, there was the whole Quickfire, and then there was a lot of sort of downtime in between because there was cooking involved to get ready for the dinner. And then, so I don't think we even sat down for dinner until like 9 o'clock at night. And then they're prepped, their cook time. I can't remember what it was. Yeah, I don't know if you have that.
I don't remember. Yeah.
I think it was two hours,
and it was a marathon day. But you know what? From a contestant standpoint, you kind of are always ready for it. At least I was always expecting to never go to sleep. Like even with the barbecue challenge where we had to stay up all night, it just felt like, oh, this is what happens. So you don't complain about it, and you're kind of always ready for it. And, you know, you heard a couple of people say, I wish we could go straight into judgment, just so that they could have gotten a like decent night's sleep. Going to bed not knowing where you stand in the competition is awful. So like I would have rather been up for 24 hours or 36 hours and found out the results and then been able to get a good night's sleep. I kind of get where they were coming from. You're already kind of amped up from the competition. You know, what's another 4 hours?
Haley, you're someone who, you know, you said you had 12 years of schooling about French living. Did you know anything about the, and I'm going to butcher this, the Réveillon de Noël?
No, I don't know about that. But I think I can get down with any dinner that features 13 desserts.
Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous.
I love how Padma was like, I have the shakes.
It was so much. It was like, I would have not eaten dinner had I realized how much it was going to be.
Like by 13, were you just like, I truly can't eat anything more sweet?
I truly felt like I couldn't take another bite after number 5.
And especially so late at night, too. Like, I don't even want to eat normal food after midnight.
It was so much.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking about like how the chef Tessin sometimes have trouble sleeping after, you know, in these big climactic moments. I can't imagine how much sleep you got after being pumped full of sugar for like 3 hours straight at 2 a.m.
Yeah, and then I had a flight at like 8 a.m. the next day. I mean, I think I fell asleep pretty quickly because I was so nauseous, but it was a lot.
Well, we hear, before we get into the challenge, we hear a bit about, you know, the chef's holiday traditions. You know, we talk about Eric sort of building a tradition off of getting stranded in the blizzard of 96. We get some lovely photos of Kevin back when he had a shaved head and goatee, which looks completely different from the Kevin we see now. We talk about, unfortunately, Nini's brother passing due to cancer. I would love to go around the horn. Do you guys have any holiday traditions that you like to do as well in the same vein of some of these chef testants and judges?
We don't have anything like super crazy, but this is the first year in my boyfriend and I's new and first home. So we're having both of our families over for brunch, which I'm really excited about. And hopefully that will turn into a tradition. Depends how well this one goes.
That's exciting, though.
Yeah.
We bake, I usually bake cookies for Santa. And then my parents sleep over, as does my sister and her husband and their daughter. And we for sure don't have enough room in our house for all of that. So it's very intimate. And we all sleep under the same roof. And then my dad reads 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. Sleep. It sounds really picture perfect, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah, it does.
All on top of each other. Nobody's real comfortable. Nobody actually sleeps. We just kind of like drink ourselves to sleep. And that's our tradition.
I think that compares nicely to Emily's family making children cry or laughing at each other's gifts.
Oh, gosh. Nah, no, that stopped a long time ago. Now, you know, my parents are visiting right now with us, which is really nice. So we usually do some sort of combined family gathering with Josh's family as well, his parents and my brother-in-law and sister-in-law. So, you know, it's just everyone loves each other, which is a really, really rare thing, I think. Like Josh's parents adore my parents. My parents feel the same towards them. So it's just one big love fest.
Yeah, I think that, I guess, if my family has a holiday tradition, it's a lack of sobriety, I suppose. At least one family member will get drunk, and at least one family member will go into some sort of conspiracy theory where they'll pull me aside and talk all about it, their newest, like, found obsession, but for, like, hours at a time. So I guess I look forward to that every year.
That's great.
It's a holiday season, you know? You make the best of your time with your family. But let's get back into this challenge. So, yes, they each have to create a dessert. So, Brooke, I mean, you're someone who, you know, you crushed one of the challenges on Charleston with a dessert that you had in your back pocket. Do you agree with Brian's logic that he admittedly doesn't follow of you need to walk into Top Chef with a dessert recipe in your back pocket?
100%. I think specifically, especially for the chefs that don't know pastry. I have pastry experience and I'm not uncomfortable in the pastry kitchen. So for me, it wasn't, I mean, I didn't have that like radish dessert in my back pocket, if that's what you're referring to. That is not something I have in my culinary repertoire. But I know how to make a panna cotta. Apparently that episode, I didn't really know how to make a panna cotta, but I can pull it together because I know how to treat pastry. And I think that's a really specific skill. And I think especially if you don't have that skill and you don't have pastry experience, like memorize two desserts, because you know that if you're going to get to a certain point in the competition, you will probably need to make something sweet. So I think it is absolutely important to feel comfortable making at least one or two things.
Yeah. Haley, Emily, I know you're both big fans of the Great British Bake Off. Were you experiencing any sort of like flashback memories? Luckily, you know, it was not hot enough to, you know, offset any of the desserts inside the house. But did you think that, there was going to be some textbook pastry errors between Top Chef and Bake Off?
Yeah, I was expecting at least one soggy bottom.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was obviously the time constraints weren't, you know, sort of helpful in the fact that you couldn't make something more elaborate, though I think a lot of people had a lot of components to their dishes. Can we just talk about Eric's like blueberry fluid gel? That's like the worst name for anything.
Oh my God. Yeah. The naming conventions of these chefs, I think, need to be improved because, yeah, the blackberry and blueberry fluid gel sounds like something that Brian puts in his hair every morning.
That's just gel. I will say that I didn't feel like these desserts in this scenario needed to be elaborate. And I feel like a lot of the chefs went in the direction of, I need to put a whole composed dessert on a plate. And I think the Réveillon de Noël specifically is more about like 13 little bites and or like petit fours almost. And I feel like if there had been more like petit four type situations, I would have really welcomed that. Like I would have loved a truffle or like a petit fouille or just a macaron. You know, I think that having a couple of little like one biter, more attention to detail, not fully composed plates of desserts, that would have been really welcomed at the table.
So that was sort of lost in translation then.
Yeah, I think it turned into literally, like, can I make for dessert, you know? And I don't think that that's what was being necessarily, I mean, I know it was a very open to interpretation challenge, you know, make a dessert. That was what they were told. But I think maybe read the scenario a little bit better and give a little gift of sweetness, you know, rather than a full blown dessert.
And it seems like that's what Nini did super well. I love when chefs just kind of stay simple for things like this. And that's what Nini did, but she killed it.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that was really what resonated with Nini's dessert and Kelsey's dessert. And I know both of them have pastry experience, but they were not overly done. They were not a giant plate of food. They were a couple of really good, sweet bites.
Well, the interesting thing about Kelsey's as well is that Kelsey's initially going for, I think, along the lines of what you were saying with this dessert trio, and she actually was making macarons, it seems, except she ran into the problem of, you know, what happens when everyone's sharing two convection ovens? Things keep opening and closing, and so things don't necessarily rise. So I will say I was a bit deceived by the edit, because I totally thought she was going to end up on the bottom here, but I thought she was able to recover nicely.
Yeah, I think she was being really ambitious by trying to create three things when I feel like one probably would have been enough. That little pot de creme was really nice, and I would have been happy with even just that. The addition of the biscotti was a great little touch, I don't even think it needed that.
I want to stop down and talk for a second about Brandon and his parents' chocolate factory. This is probably one of the most insane things, pieces of backstory I've seen on a contestant. And this is after Michelle declared that her grandmother was a witch. I think that maybe just because Brandon has really grown on me, then maybe the initial bitter taste that he left in my mouth in that first episode. I mean, can we say I think Brandon is the son of Charlie Bucket. I'm just going to put it out there. I think Charlie Bucket inherited Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. He reopened it as Leah Gold's Phantasma Dazzle Magic Chocolate Factory.
It's the best ever.
That is the craziest name. That's like the Magical Emporium, whatever Heath Ledger's last movie was. That's a very similar naming convention. But just Brandon offhandedly mentioned that his parents own a chocolate factory is, I don't know. Emily, did you have a reaction to it? Because I was beside myself. It was incredible.
I mean, I thought for a second to like rewind it and try to write down all the names that were associated with it. And then I was like, hopefully someone else took notes, because that is just like a mouthful. And then he was like, and then I used to eat all of the like imperfect chocolates. And I'm like, of course you did, Brandon. Of course you did.
Yeah, so that's how he's gained his standards for beauty, is because he's used to eating all the ugly things.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, it was great. I mean, and then those little like photos of him being like a devious little boy on the side of like a conveyor belt.
So good. So I figured, you know, since Brooke is here, and since it is a bit surprising that we did get feedback from each and every dish, I figured, you know what, let's do a bit of a marathon here. Let's go dish by dish, just because Brooke, I know you can provide a lot of insight trying to remember back into the sweet coma you found yourself in that late night. So I want to start with Eddie here. Now, Eddie, again, coming in typical Eddie, a very nervous place. He had just come off of, you know, screwing his team over the previous week. He said his wife's a pastry chef. Hopefully he can pull on her experience. He makes strawberry shortcake with almond streusel and fennel. Tom loved the fennel combo. Eric Repair was all over that texture with the crumble. Brooke, can you give me some of your thoughts about what Eddie put out here that ultimately put him in the top?
It was fine.
Whoa, Savage Brooke is out to play.
I mean, it was fine. It was fine. I wasn't in the same place that Tom was or that Eric was. I felt like it was a nicely composed sort of play on a strawberry shortcake. I think the fresh element of the fennel was nice. Did I feel like technically it blew me away? Like, no, but it was fine.
Emily, we see a bit of a rise here from Eddie. We even get a smile out of him for the first time maybe in his life. Do we think this is going to bode well for Eddie Money moving forward?
I mean, we've seen him at his lowest. Now we're seeing him, you know, sort of rising up from the ashes. So it should be interesting to follow him. You know, I think he's a compelling character.
But like, literally doesn't smile. Honestly, yeah. It freaked me out a little bit in the quick fire, because he was just standing there and I thought maybe he was sick. I thought maybe he was going to pass out. And he was like, he was fine. He was just standing there I feel like he's just that guy that's very serious and doesn't smile at all ever. I don't know. I don't know him, but that's what I got from him.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if like, I wouldn't call it like resting bitch face, but like, I don't even know what to refer to it as.
It's like a resting anxiety face.
Yeah.
I love it. RAF for Eddie. Let's move on to someone who does not fare so well. Haley, what's been going on with Pablo? He finished in the top in the very first elimination challenge, but the past two, he's been in the bottom and nearly went home.
Yeah, I feel like Pablo doesn't have a great sense of what he's doing in a way where, like, he can't reflect on a dish and be like, there are some issues and this is what they are. It kind of seems like he goes into it being like, oh my God, you didn't like my dish. Where, like, the other two people in the bottom are like, yeah, I knew I had issues. But Pablo was just kind of like, I'm rocking it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I just like, and watching him like slam like the dough onto the cookie sheet where he's like, I'm just making this. And I was like, that does not look like it's going to be good.
Yeah. Brooke, Tom says that, you know, literally everything on this dish went wrong. What was your overall opinion on, you know, the thing that he ended up, the take on the sablé that he tried to put out there?
It was super confusing. It was just, it was a giant, dense sugar cookie. Like, it couldn't have been flaky if you saw how he was making it. It, you know, by slamming like warm dough onto a sheet tray, and it was this sort of freeform, dense cookie with some unripe raspberries just like delicately placed on top of it. I don't even really remember that ganache sauce very well. So,
because it wasn't a sauce, it was like wasn't it?
It's like it had seized. So it wasn't silky or creamy like a ganache could be. I don't know what happened. I don't know if he added like water to it or something. I don't know what happened there, but it had seized. It was very confusing. It was very hard to eat. And it was really big too.
Was it deserving of the bottom three in your opinion?
Yeah.
Well, let's keep bottom feeding here and move on to Brian, who again admits he's a meat guy, not a sweet guy. So he decides to, you know, try to go for this like conventional shortbread biscuit with the dried fruit and pistachio butter and sour cream. He says, you know what, I don't want it to be too sweet. So he pickles some cocoa nib, which ends up just apparently adding a heaping amount of acid that nearly sends him home here. Emily, what was your ultimate take on Brian's dessert?
Well, he said he used apple cider vinegar, and that is just such a pungent and specific flavor. I don't know. ACV just felt like the wrong thing to throw in there with the mix. I mean, he just had a lot of things that looked like they were going on, but not necessarily harmonizing into a real, you know, conceivable dish for me, at least. So, I mean, Brooke, you were there. What did you think?
It wasn't sweet and it wasn't savory. I feel like he made sort of a gastrique fruit compote on like a savory biscuit. It wasn't enough moisture, but like I didn't want more of the moisture because it was very super acidic. It didn't read like a dessert to me, and it didn't read like something that should be in this specific scenario at all. And can we just touch on does anybody feel like Brian resembles Joe Flam at all?
Yes, 100%. Yes. Rockstar Joe Flam.
Okay, so we've already talked about that. I mean, I haven't, but
have we talked about it? Or is it
no?
Just
if he feels like Joe Flam's older brother who's like at college. He's got like the glasses. He's got the tattoos going on. Like, it seems like if we're talking about the general family of these, you know, high haired white male chefs, that they could be siblings.
Yeah, I just dawned on me while looking at this picture. And I keep wanting to call him Joe, but it's Brian. So, this dessert didn't feel appropriate for the situation.
Do you agree with Tom that if there was some cheese added on, it could have made it a bit more palatable?
Yeah, if it had been maybe deconstructed a little bit and treated like a cheese plate, absolutely. Like, the acidity could have played off of the richness of like a ripened or like a brie-like cheese. He could have gone a couple of directions with this to make it feel like a cheese plate. But the request was to make a dessert. So I was trying to read it that way. I don't know. I think everybody was.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to Nini, who ends up making her second elimination winning dish in a row, a blackberry and lemon vacherin. Am I saying that right? I'm not entirely sure. Something like that. Yeah. Haley, what did you think about Nini's dish? Did this stand out to you as much as it did to the judges?
Yeah, like it just seems so like classic and perfect with the night. The blackberry and lemon would have been a nice tart, especially when there are so many sweet, heavy dishes going on around it. It just seems like it would be like a welcome break from that.
Mm-hmm. Brooke, what did you feel like this was this as clear as David's quickfire win was in the moment as to like this is definitely, you know, the one that's going to take it all?
No, but it definitely felt like a top dish. It felt like all of the components made sense. It was very beautifully presented. It felt like somebody who knew what they were doing in a pastry kitchen.
Moving on, we have David, and this is what you're talking about before, Brooke, with maybe smaller being better. He goes for what Padma calls a shot glass of fun, which Kurt wanted me to point out was his nickname in college. Hopefully he was attending the same college as Joe Flam's older brother, Brian. His banana cream cheese trifle with macadamia nut and bacon streusel. Brooke, I know you were hooked from the beginning because you are a huge fan of thyme used in dessert, which I'll admit, maybe this is just me being uncultured. I didn't really know it was a, you know, big dessert combo, unless you're just, it's a very eclectic one.
No, I like fresh herbs in desserts. I feel like it adds a really sort of complexity that you can't get just by adding salt or bacon. Or I feel like he added a lot to this little shot glass, and Padma liked it. It was pleasant to eat. It was a nice little bite. I felt like it fit the challenge very well. It was too many components for me specifically. There was just a lot going on in that shot glass, none of which were insulting. But it felt like a lot to me. So as much as it was a nice couple of bites, I felt like he could have lost a couple of the ingredients.
Mm. What dessert were you insulted by?
The one thing that sticks out in my head was the salty biscuit. Was that Kevin?
Yeah, so Kevin, we can actually move right on into Kevin. So yeah, Kevin produces the losing dish, his ricotta cake with ricotta, whipped cream, and macerated cherries that probably contain ricotta in it as well. And yeah, Brooke, can you describe from like a technical perspective what exactly you think happened? Because he was talking about he added too much salt, and then like as it went away, like he tried to add stuff into it to make it work, but it ended up making it more salty. It was a little confusing to me at the outset.
I don't know if he realized how salty it was, honestly. To be honest, I think that in retrospect, when you're being told things are wrong, sometimes it's easier just to be like, oh, that was really wrong. I'm just going to agree and say that I knew that that was wrong. But I think that the salt was not evenly distributed throughout the dough. And so there were bites that were probably fine that he tasted that were fine. But then there were bites that felt like there was so much salt, it was inedible. To me, that was a very first and foremost, like this, I can't eat this kind of a dish because it's so salty. And I don't know that he knew that when he brought it out.
And that's so interesting because, I mean, Tom makes this comment later on a judge's table of like, if you know it's that bad, don't put it on the plate. But I guess there's something in there to your point, Brooke, that if he didn't really know it was that salty, he put it on the plate to, I guess to his own detriment. Emily, how did you feel about sort of, I guess, Tom's response to that? The general idea of, in his opinion, you know, if there's a component that doesn't work, don't mask it, just completely eliminate it.
I mean, you're on Top Chef. You're supposed to be able to self-edit to the point where you're really competing against a lot of other people that know what they're doing, you know? So it is interesting to sort of see him be like completely, you know, out of this where he's like, oh, yeah, no, it's fine. And like, you know, Brandon was like, yo, that's a little salty, dude. Like you see him taste some of it before he plates anything. My real question is, like, how do you actually remedy something like that? Do you just start from scratch again or, you know, scrap it completely? Or would there have been something to do to kind of fix it? I mean, he says he added more butter, which is like, yeah, you can add more fat, but it's still going to be salty. Like, you know, is there a way to throw more sugar into it? Or are you just like, no, start over?
No, I don't think you can balance an oversalting situation. I think it's a matter of like, let me take maybe some more berries and cook them down with a little bit of sugar. And then I can add a touch of what I've already made to this. Mm-hmm. But the dough itself had a ton of salt. So it wasn't
And that's hard.
It was throughout the entire dessert. There was salt in every component. And like you see me say, I'm a big fan of salt. I feel like a dessert needs to be balanced with a certain amount of salt, but I also don't want to taste that salt. The salt should be used to the point where it balances the sweet without you noticing the salt, unless it's blatant, like, you know, sea salt on top of a cookie or a brownie or something where you want that crunch and texture and flavor of the salt. That was not the case here.
Let's move forward because we'll definitely be talking about Kemen later on as well. Sarah, going for a bit of her own Kentucky homeliness, talks about her church fold biscuit with hibiscus and ginger infused fresh berries, some coconut whooped cream, because as she says, it's more fun when you say whooped, and some macadamia nuts. She does not get whooped here in terms of the challenge, but does not get necessarily positive comments. Haley, did you have any thoughts about the biscuit that Sarah put out here?
It didn't look overly appetizing. It just, I was a little bored by it.
Mm-hmm. Brooke, were you bored in the moment as Haley was by this as well?
Yeah, I wasn't super impressed. I also don't feel like I want a biscuit for dessert, and there were like four of them.
Yeah.
It was filling. It was not super doughy, moist or flaky, moist and buttery. I feel like, yeah, I was a little bored by it.
So let's move on then to someone who fared a bit better. We talked about Kelsey, how she had to pivot from doing the trio of desserts to this pot de creme with the citrus topping, with the biscotti on the side, a bit of a take on milk and cookies, goes over really well. Eric Repair's favorite dessert of them all. Brooke, I gotta assume you've talked favorably about this before. That's pretty far up there for you as well.
Yeah, for sure. And it didn't feel to me like she had to pivot in any way whatsoever, which is really nice to see when you're having issues in the kitchen and you can recover to the point where nobody knows that you had an issue. It says something. So I feel like it didn't feel like anything was missing. I didn't care that it wasn't a trio. It felt like the biscotti with the pot de creme was all it needed to be. And like I said, I don't even feel like the biscotti needed to be, that felt extra to me. So yeah, it felt simple and well executed.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Emily, that there's something about, you know, Tom calls this the perfect treat for Christmas? And to Brooke's point, do you think there was more of a point that was sort of a underlying, not necessarily mentioned, about the fact that, like, this is still a holiday theme at the end of the day, and you want to think back to your own holiday traditions and what you would want to eat as a dessert?
Yeah, I mean, that's why maybe a strawberry shortcake doesn't really feel like it fits the profile for this particular challenge, right?
That's true. Or cheese and fruit.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, cheese and fruit can be a holiday related thing. But, you know, there are certain things in this where it was just like, no, you're kind of missing the point. Or, yeah, it does seem like it's too much. But yeah, pot de creme seems very homey and sort of, you know, like a comfort level sort of dessert that would fit in.
So we have someone, I feel like Adrian sort of falls into the same pot as Pablo here in terms of, I think, really trying to show off a lot of skill and impress Eric Repair, specifically with their knowledge of, you know, French techniques, because she makes this almond de croix, and the de croix apparently is pleasant. But Brooke, you compared her marmalade to frozen orange juice.
That's exactly what it tasted like. It tasted like she had pulled, you know, those like round frozen
cans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if it's Minute Maid or something, and like shaved it into a like an orange ice or something, just straight out of the can. Like I felt like it wasn't maybe sweetened enough, or maybe it didn't have any structure. And I also feel like in that kind of a scenario, putting like an ice on top of something, unless you know it's going to be eaten right away, is dangerous, because it's going to melt and it's going to feel diluted and it's going to make everything underneath it soggy. no matter how quickly it's eaten, it just felt like melted frozen orange juice over the top of a dessert. And I don't think it added any, I think it took away from a well-made cake.
Mm. So Haley, this is the, you know, I think I'm sensing a bit of a theme here with Adrienne, where last week she does well for herself, but I'm wondering if there's a couple times where she finds herself sort of biting off more than she can chew, both between trying to make the tortellini and failing, and now this, where I think she tried to, show this big French dessert that ended up not really working in one big component, to Brooke's point, sort of souring the whole bunch. Are you seeing that sort of similar pattern from her as well?
Yeah, Adrienne is like the poster child this season for trying too hard in every dish. Like, she could be so much more effective if she just kind of scales back and does one or two things really well rather than trying to do like 4 to 7 different things kind of mediocrely, because she can't really complete any of them in a way that makes sense. I've just been kind of disappointed in Adrienne. She's getting like overly complicated for no reason.
Mm. Yeah. So I guess we'll have to put a pin in that and see, hopefully, you have people, I think like Adrienne's an example of someone who learned early on, like, do not complicate things, especially in challenges like this where simple concept worked better. And I thought she learned her lesson last week, but maybe it was just the head games of it all that really affected her here. Let's move on to Brandon. I don't think chocolatiering is in the family, buddy. I'm so sorry about that. Because, Padma expressed her extreme displeasure for Brandon's dish here. Brooke, did you have a similar reaction to his chocolate mousse?
Can you explain the components one more time?
Yeah, so she had a white chocolate mousse, a caramel blood orange, and candied orange zest with toasted pecan cake. Basically, Padma complained that everything was mushy, and the caramel was a quote-unquote unpleasant surprise.
Yeah, well, I'm not a huge fan of white chocolate to begin with. I feel like it's unbalancedly sweet. And it wasn't, I don't know, the texture of it wasn't great, and it just felt sweet. And then there was like this little surprise of caramel sauce at the bottom, which is the last thing I want to be surprised with a white, a slightly too sweet white chocolate mousse. It just felt mushy all the way through with very little texture, and it was too sweet.
Emily, were you surprised that Brandon didn't end up in the bottom here for the second elimination challenge in the row, considering that, from what Brooke was describing, this dessert just did not go over well at all?
I actually was surprised by it. Watching him just pour so much Cointreau into a saucepan during prep, and I was just like, oh, what are you doing, man? Like, don't do that. he obviously has, been cocky throughout the 3 episodes we've seen so far. It's kind of nice to see someone who's that cocky get knocked down a peg or two. But, I think this, is one more thing where it's like, maybe we needed to say a little more to you, right? Like, maybe you just needed to get your wits about you and really kind of come back collected and sort of re-execute things a little bit more smartly.
Here's an interesting, go ahead, Brooke.
No, I totally agree with that, but I think the reason why it didn't end up on the bottom here, and as much as maybe you wanted to hear more about it, there wasn't a whole lot to say about it. It was, again, it was not good, but it was definitely not the most offensive dessert.
I believe that, yeah.
What I find so interesting is sort of Justin's choice this episode, because he is someone who says, I don't really eat dessert. And this always brings up a question that we've asked a few times on the podcast, and I would love for you to answer, Brooke. I mean, if you're a chef and your challenge is to cook with an ingredient that you don't necessarily like or use that much, how do you sort of work around that obstacle to create a dish that doesn't put you in the bottom?
You just do it. I mean, if you are a chef with years of experience who's cooked for the general public, I cook stuff for people all the time that I don't necessarily want to eat. You just do it, because that's what you're asked to do. My customers come into my restaurant and they want things that will make them happy, and my job is to provide that happiness. So, regardless of, I hate liver. It's never something I'll order. I don't like chicken liver. I don't even really like foie gras. But I will cook it, absolutely. And I know how to cook it, and that's part of my job.
Mm-hmm. Haley, we get, you know, Justin pumping out this blue cheese mousse, which I'll admit, I agree with the judges here, does not sound very appetizing, just those ideas smushed together.
I like blue cheese, and I like mousse, but I don't want you to take, like, the texture of blue cheese and make it not that by making it mousse.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if he was going for a fruit and cheese thing, I don't know, I didn't necessarily get the fruit idea. It just seemed more like cheese and bacon.
Where was the fruit element?
Yeah, he had chestnuts in there, which I guess is sort of like has that fruitiness, nuttiness to it. But other
but it
than
doesn't
that,
have
I guess
any, it, like, any sweetness to make it not, like, salty and savory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this was an unfortunate miss by the guy who was not a big fan of desserts, so I guess it's an understandable result. Apparently someone named Michelle made a dish, and she went for some baked chocolate with roasted cherries, ginger, and hazelnuts. Brooke, I have to assume that you were probably nearing, you know, the point of unconsciousness with sugar at this point. Do you remember anything about this brownie?
Again, like I said, my job was to taste all the desserts, so I did it, regardless of how I felt. and I actually remember this dessert really well. This is something that actually sticks out in my head, because it was something that she called it baked chocolate, which was confusing to me because it wasn't like a souffle. It wasn't a pot de creme. It was basically a baked flourless chocolate cake or a baked brownie or something in a ramekin. That's kind of how it came off to me. And I understand the desire to not want to overly sweeten a dark chocolate dessert. It turns it into something completely different than a sweet sort of brighter chocolate dessert. This dessert had virtually no sugar in it. So I feel like I couldn't get the as much flavor out of the chocolate as I wanted to. I kind of also just didn't know what it was, and it also needed some moisture. So there were a couple of things that, like, I feel like she could have done something really spectacular with that baked chocolate had she added maybe one more component and amped up the sugar. And I feel like it was just a couple of missteps that turned it into something that wasn't what we wanted it to be.
Let's finish things off here with Eric, who reaches back to his roots. He has this memory of 2 years old running down the road to ask for this beaufrot, which is sort of this like Ghanaian version of a beignet or a donut. And this is an example, Brooke, of what you're talking about. It seemed like it was super simple, despite maybe the odd naming of the blackberry and blueberry fluid gel. The combination of that with the creme anglaise and the chocolate crumbs really turned out well. Emily, what did you think about Eric sort of finishing off the meal here?
I've never met a beignet I didn't like. So that, to be fair, I've only eaten like the ones from Cafe Du Monde in New Orleans. But still, it looked really tasty and fun to eat. And right, not super complicated and probably the right portion size compared to a lot of other desserts on the table, at least from what we could see. So maybe not. No.
It was huge.
Okay.
And it was a very far cry from Café Du Monde.
Got it.
It was not a beignet. It was a donut. It was not a risen donut either. It was like a cake donut that was kind of dense. It was very dense. But also, it was massive, and I feel like I got to it. We all kind of got to it toward the end of what was on the table. I also didn't realize we'd each get 13 desserts in front of us. So it was very obvious if we hadn't like really gone into one. But it was a lot. It was good in its own way. It was aggressive. From a proportion, it was large, it was dense, but it was, again, not the most offensive thing on the table.
I mean, I don't know, it sounds like the perfect thing to end your meal is a baseball-sized donut to just dig into.
So big.
Maybe if it was the only thing that you had to end your meal with, right?
Yeah, I mean, we sell these... like a cake donut dessert at Playa Provisions, and it's three giant cake donuts that have some like compote and whipped cream and ice cream, and it's a very large dessert and very filling. We do like an apple fritter. We kind of change it around the seasons, and that's a kind of a little bit what this felt like to me. But again, that dessert should be serving 3 to 4 people. And this felt the same way.
Did you feel some sort of, whether, you know, unconscious or not, some sort of impact by the fact that, you know, you were getting full to the point of where it's sort of like the opposite of what happens with the Yankee swap, where those that go farther to the back might face a bit more criticism just because the judges are in a certain mood by the time they get to their dishes?
No, I think we honestly kept a very open mind, regardless of how ill we felt.
So getting into judges table of it all, I would just love to, you know, I'll read through the tops and the bottoms here. And Brooke, I would love to hear from your own personal opinion, I guess, who you would, you know, from your own perspective, if you agree or disagree with their decisions. So the tops from the judges' perspectives were Kelsey, Nene, and Eddie. Was there anyone that you would want to sub out in lieu of these three folks?
No, I feel like that was really reflective of the general consensus of the entire table.
Haley, any reactions to Nene winning her second elimination challenge in a row? I feel like if we're talking about, you know, the unprecedented aspect of Natalie going home after winning the first elimination challenge, I feel like it's very rare that we get, you know, someone winning 2 out of 3 of the first elimination challenges.
Yeah, I even thought maybe I was watching the wrong episode on my DVR because we had David win both quickfires and Nene win both elimination challenges. I was like, what's going on here? I was super happy for Nene. I really like her, and I'm happy that she's killing it. Knock on wood.
Yeah, Emily, what are you thinking? I asked you about David before. What are you thinking about Nene's chances as well as you know, someone who has been consistently putting up challenge winning work in the past few episodes?
I mean, she seems like kind of like a secret boss, right? Like she's just kind of like, oh, well, I'm just going to make this thing. And then she's like, bam, here you go. So she's been really fun to watch so far. And, you know, sort of listening, you know, I think a lot of the edit shows, you know, people's emotional components, you know, related to the holidays, right? So her talking about losing her brother, I mean, that gives a lot more depth to her as a contestant, right? That sort of shows a little bit more of her side of things. And then obviously the flip side of it, we learn more about Kevin. And while I was watching this, Josh was just like, got to watch out for Kevin. I think we got to be worried about him, which is like the hardest thing when you live with somebody who understands reality television to the extent that he does. Like, he's always just like, well, that person's getting voted off next. And I'm like, Josh, we're 5 minutes in, really? And he's like, yeah, well, you know, it's just what's going to happen. So, of course, that kind of sort of moves us ahead to final elimination. But, you know, I really think Nene's someone to keep an eye out for. I really love all that she's done thus far. And I think she's a really interesting person to keep an eye out, you know, to watch. I think she's great.
I love this is the equivalent of like going to the movies with someone who like works on a movie to be
yeah,
like,
totally.
That boom's in frame. Like, how did they frame that shot where you get too much inside baseball, baseball sized donut.
I when the boom is in frame. I hate that. Or you can see Mike. I hate that too.
Triggered. So now poor Kevin ends up going here. Haley, were you surprised to see Kevin go home over Pablo and Brian?
No, because like, I mean, kind of like Emily was saying, you know, Josh picked up on the fact that like we see, oh God, what's his name? Kevin. We see Kevin like talk about his wife and how he turned down a job and how he had like a bit of a backstory. And I didn't feel like we got that from Pablo and we didn't get that from Brian. So I was like, see you later, Kevin. Sorry, man.
Yeah, on that note about the story, I mean, Brooke, you're someone who also, you know, obviously is in the culinary world and has started a family as well. Did you have any reactions to hearing about Kevin's decision to sort of, you know, leave behind this opportunity in New York City to go back to small town Iowa and raise a family?
Yeah, he said that. It's funny that you even bring that up. He said that I was watching with my husband. I was watching this. And when that story came about and was over, we both just looked at each other. We were like, can you say resentment.
Oh my God.
And I don't know that that's the situation here, but that is a position that both, you know, my husband's a chef, and we have never, ever wanted to stand in each other's way to do anything for fear that that would turn into later resentment. And I don't think this was a situation where his wife like stood in his way and said, please don't take this job. It didn't come off that way. It just felt like a situation where like he had these great opportunities and he made a specific reference to turning down the best job opportunity he's ever been given to go start a family. And it felt like, oh God, why did he do that? when in my head, I'm like, why can't you do it all? You know, why can't you start a family in New York? You know, there are sacrifices that need to be made on both sides. You know, I don't think my husband, I, in fact, I know my husband wasn't super excited for me to leave for 7 weeks to go shoot Top Chef, but that was a sacrifice he was willing to make so that I didn't later in life regret not doing something. So that was a story that really resonated specifically between my husband and I.
Let's eulogize Kevin here a bit. Emily, bit of a tumultuous few episodes for Kevin. Any thoughts about him as a contestant on Top Chef?
You know, I think the beet salad, man. I mean, when he was like, I'm going to make this beet salad, I was like, Kevin, you are not long for this world. Like, you know, I mean, there are really great ways of making a beet salad, of course, but, you know, I don't know. I think, you know, his days seemed sort of numbered pretty early on, as suggested and seen, but.
Make that beet salad for a nostalgia challenge.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, he seems like a really nice guy. I don't know. We'll see how he does with Last Chance Kitchen. That's, you know, another component we haven't really brought up yet, but, you know, I think, I don't know. I have a lot of feelings about Kevin, but they're all just sort of like, eh.
They all just sort of like squeeze towards the middle. I mean, Haley, I guess on that note of Last Chance Kitchen, you know, Last Chance Kitchen, I feel like, is a very time sensitive and pressurized environment. We know that Kevin ends up a bit covered in flour when those circumstances happened. What do we think about his chances without spoiling the Last Chance Kitchen results? But in general, do we think Last Chance Kitchen is a proper venue for Kevin to sort of spread his wings?
No.
Okay. That's short and sweet, unlike a lot of these desserts. Well, anything else that anybody wants to bring about the episode proper before we finish off with some LCK talk without hopefully not as much spirited arguing as the last time we visited Last Chance Kitchen?
Oh my God. I was like, cut it out.
That was a really deep conversation you guys had. I mean, it was extensive.
You mean that Antonio and Josh had together? We were both like, Josh, what's going on here now? Are we still talking about this?
Yeah. It was too much. Way too much.
Well, let's stay in the holiday spirit here as we move into Last Chance Kitchen, as we have brother Carrie, Natalie, and now Kevin with his Run DMC glasses cooking. Cooking not only a big hearty holiday breakfast, but also using some lovely Hidden Valley Ranch seasoning mix. Brooke, I mean, you only spent, you know, one episode basically in Last Chance Kitchen, but you didn't get the opportunity, I should say, to use any Hidden Valley stuff in your dishes, right?
I didn't, but there was a Hidden Valley challenge that Casey, I remember Casey won because she made some like chicken fingers that were coated in ranch seasoning. I don't know, those ranch challenges are something that I'm bummed that I missed out on.
So Emily, I'm assuming you must have loved this challenge, considering it's basically all the chefs were like, how can I use eggs and ranch to make some sort of breakfast dish?
I know. I'm sorry. I'm allergic to eggs. I really am. But pairing it with Last Ranch Kitchen is what we should call it. It was interesting to watch. I like the idea of ranch waffles. I think Kevin had a pretty cool idea with that. I think Carrie did so many things. I think brother had an interesting sort of composition of all these different components as well. And then Natalie, I think her dish looked really good. Just from like a very basic perspective. I really liked the look of hers.
Yeah, Natalie is so interesting to me because it just seems like, my God, is she a risky chef? It seems like literally every challenge, she's like, I know I'm taking a risk by doing this. And I keep saying, like, Natalie, stop it. Because the time she took a risk was the time she went home for the freaking lemon curd pie. But here she makes an omelet for Tom. And Tom sort of gives the backhanded compliment of, you made as perfect of an omelet as you could. But it seems like, Haley, she was able to, you know, the risk actually paid off here. And it seems like now she's able to shake the rust off a bit from nearly getting eliminated in Last Chance Kitchen again. And she finishes first here.
Yeah, I just had like bad flashbacks to when Laura made an omelet and she poured it onto yes. her onto the plate.
Oh, my God. It was her and it was Rogelio. And it was, I remember it was the sudden death quick fire where Tom just admonished all of them for just making god awful omelets of like, just put mushrooms and eggs in a dish. That's all you need.
Horrifying. That was the worst. That was horrifying.
There's nothing I like more than when my omelet is poured.
Oh, my God. And I'll give her credit as well. I think in terms of if you have to use ranch, I think the ranch potato pancake, I feel like that's a good mixture. I'll have a ranch latke. I'll try it.
Yeah, totally.
Please sign me up for any and all potato pancakes.
Brooke, I know that, you know, obviously as an expert on the timing that comes to Top Chef, were you worried when we had to see that brother had to remake his frittata that it wouldn't, again, speaking of runny eggs, that it wouldn't come underneath the time limit?
I feel like I really would have worried had I seen Last Chance Kitchen.
That's fine. You're taking Josh's spot on this podcast where you just haven't seen Last Chance Kitchen.
I didn't have a chance to watch it. And also, I'm not like compelled to watch Last Chance Kitchen.
Damn right. Yes, Brooke. Yes.
I'm sorry. I just, it's an extra thing that I don't need on my plate. I suppose I should have done it because I was doing this podcast, but no. I didn't want to.
There was one time where I literally forgot to watch Last Chance Kitchen until like Mike brought it up and was like, hey, so what did you think about this? And I was like, I have no idea what I thought about it, to be honest with you. I forgot.
This is a bridge that we have trod many a time before. So like, don't feel ashamed of it whatsoever, especially again, given the spirited destruction.
So Brooke, how do you feel about Last Chance Kitchen being a part of the Top Chef game? Do you think it has any merits as a competition that you have to watch alongside Top Chef proper?
Apparently not.
I love it.
I actually don't mind the show. I think it's fun. I think I like Tom's personality, and I like the sort of shift in personality that he takes a little bit because he can on this show. And I don't mind him as a judge because I really love him as a person. And I think he really is very himself on Last Chance Kitchen.
What I don't like about it? That it robbed you.
Well, I mean, you could say either way.
It taketh and it giveth.
Yeah, it robbed you and then it gave back to you. It essentially stole stuff from your house and then returned the stuff to you 2 years later.
Right. So we're kind of even Stevens. So, but yeah, I suppose you could say had there not been a Last Chance Kitchen, I wouldn't have ever had to have done season 14.
Yeah,
fair.
So, you know,
but that's true.
I don't know. I don't know that that's specifically true. I'm not a, you know, I'm not a fortune teller, but I, you know, am happy it existed, I suppose, the second time around. I'm just going to stop.
I'm sorry. I just kicked it up a notch, but I had to.
You're turning up the heat, which makes sense from a culinary Indeed. Perspective, a podcasting perspective, and the fact it took place in May. I'll for Brooke and the uninitiated, I'll sort of go through the rankings as to how each person finished and the thing that they make. So again, they have to make a sumptuous breakfast feast, which I think, again, if we're talking about misinterpretation of instructions, I think Carrie interprets it to be like, Tom talks about, like, you want a meal that feeds your whole, your extended family Christmas morning. I think Carrie took that to mean, like, a whole smorgasbord of things rather than one simple meal. So Natalie comes in first. She makes an omelet with morel mushrooms, asparagus, pancetta, and the ranch potato pancake that Tom absolutely loves. Second place goes to Brother. So Brother channels his 10-year wedding anniversary trip to Italy. And again, speaking of, like, a breakfast of fruits and cheeses, he makes a frittata with truffle, asparagus, tomato, and a strawberry salad with ranch ricotta, which
What?
I mean, drink every time ricotta is mentioned in the course of this episode. It's wait, yeah. And
sorry, can you say that dish again?
A frittata with truffle, asparagus, and tomato, and then on the side, a strawberry salad with ranch ricotta.
No, brother, what are you doing?
Like Tom was like, you put strawberries in this?
Yeah. But apparently the savoriness of the ricotta, I guess, balanced it out. So I was worried as well for brother when Tom sort of mentioned that, like, hey, you sure you want to put strawberries in? But I guess it worked out well for him. Kevin was able to squeak by here. He made a ranch waffle with pancetta and a maple compote with a 7-minute egg. And I'm giving that to Kevin Reed because he extended his word as Tom cut into the egg. Because he didn't actually know if it was done well enough. But apparently it was, and it has him earning a victory here over the shocking boot of Carrie. So yeah, Carrie goes for basically an entire, like, grand slam at Denny's. She makes ranch bacon and potatoes with blueberry sausage, soft scrambled eggs, and fancy toast in loose quotes. I think, again, she sort of falls due to the naming conventions here, where Tom basically says, you're known for making fancy toast, and all she did was toast some ciabatta and put some jelly on it. Haley, I know you're a huge Carrie fan. Did you agree with the decision to eliminate her here?
Yes, but I'm going to be forever resentful for it.
To Tom or just the general idea?
Just general idea, I believe. I can't say mad at Tom.
That's true. This is like picking between children almost. Yeah. Do you side with Tom or do you side with Carrie?
I just get mad at the universe instead.
So Emily, which would you rather have, blueberry sausage or blueberry and blackberry gel foam or whatever gel liquid?
Fluid gel.
I don't know how I can describe it to Brooke, but it was like a purple tinged sausage, and it looked like something out of Dr. Seuss, and not in a good way.
Yeah, Tom was not feeling it.
Oh, well, that's sad. So that was it for her?
Yeah, yeah, surprisingly. Again, and I think that last week you guys were even talking about that, like, Carrie stands the best chance of a vet to enter re-enter the game. And now we only have one left. Do we think that there's a chance at this point that brother's going to be the one coming back? Or do we think that, you know, it's going to be a newbie entering no matter what?
Who are you asking?
The world.
Dead air.
Is that rhetorical?
No, that was Michelle's time to talk. She blew in and said something very quickly.
Mike, what do you think?
Oh, boy. Again, turning the question back on me. I love it. I don't know. I don't think brother's chances are looking good, to be quite honest.
Agreed.
I think last season, there was a, when we had, it was Kwame and Leanne and Claudette who all had a chance of coming back. Like, there was a very good chance that one vet would re-enter the game, but these vets are, I don't know if it's the cookery of the season 16 contestants or just the unpreparedness of the vets, but they're surprisingly falling by the wayside right now. So I could see brother maybe lasting one more episode, but I don't know if we're going to have someone re-enter the competition halfway through again. I don't know if it's going to be him. I honestly am putting my money on Natalie at this point.
Agreed.
Maybe that's my hope, but I think that she has recovered, and I could see if we're looking into, like, things from an editing perspective, I think she could be the one to make the comeback halfway through.
I think LCK is a total crapshoot. I think, that it has to do with your frame of mind at that moment, what you're able to do with the time constraints. If you're given an ingredient that you know really well or excited about, I honestly feel like there's no way to predict LCK. And I don't know. I feel like you guys read into the edit way more than I do, because I read more from the confessionals than I do from the edit. I read into their moods. I read into how they're talking about their dishes. And sometimes it's totally off because, I mean, the confessionals happen after they've already performed, you know? So I read more into that than how the edit plays off.
No, I think that's a really interesting point, because, I mean, you can certainly edit around what things, what people are saying, but I think that's the most genuine way to sort of capture the mood about how they feel about the dish, and they can sort of, you know, pick and choose how they feel to make us feel a similar way to a certain dish one way or the other. So
yeah, I guess that's sort of, I don't think that that necessarily always pans out to give away how something went, because if, you know, if I reflect back to that specific radish dessert challenge, or the radish challenge where I made a dessert, I was having a lot of issues, and I was strangely able to recover to the extent of winning the challenge. But I don't know that that happens very often. But if you had just been reading my confessionals, I mean, I was going through the motions of what I was feeling in that moment, and it was really chaotic, and I didn't have a lot of hope for what was going on in the moment. But when I finally pulled the dish together, I felt good about it.
Next week, we've got a whopper here, or a whooper, as it were. We have, for the first time, Restaurant Wars with three teams of four. First off, Emily, what is your reaction to not only finding out that Restaurant Wars is this early, but that we are going to be opening up three mini restaurants rather than two?
I mean, it's very stressful, and watching everyone in the edit for next week, it doesn't look like it's going well.
Yeah, it's edited like a, I don't know, like a horror movie or something. Where we do a lot of like these like media res cuts in where people are like, it's not going right.
Yeah, did you touch this? Blown up. No.
Yeah, everyone's screaming each other. Like, you have, I think it was Adrian yelling like, don't listen to him. You got to listen to me. It's just a lot of intensity going on. I mean, Brooke, yeah, I can imagine if this was bringing up any sort of like, I mean, you've done very well in both of your Restaurant Wars attempts, but I can only imagine how much like PTSD watching this brought up for you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't think of a preview of Restaurant Wars where you don't see a lot of chaos happening. It's a very chaotic challenge. Working in conjunction with people who you don't know very well. Like, even the fact that it's this close to the beginning of the season, I think I play more on that than I do about the number of restaurants. Like, who cares? Three restaurants. It's interesting, but that's not what's interesting to me about it. What's interesting to me is the fact that that they don't know each other very well at this point. You know, even in my second Restaurant Wars, I knew Shirley well, you know, like I had we were the team that had two rookies on our team, and the other team had all vets. But I even felt like I knew those two rookies very well because I had been living with them and competing with them for an extra, you know, week or two, which makes a big difference when you're, you know, spending so much time with somebody to get to know how they are personally. And I think that plays a huge part into Restaurant Wars, is just the dynamic between people.
So from what I determined from, you know, peeking through the preview, it looks like our teams are, and tune out for the next minute or so if you don't want to be potentially spoiled by it, but I thought I'd read it off for speculation. Kelsey, Nene, Justin, and David. We have Adrian, Eric, Eddie, and Sarah. And then we have Michelle, Pablo, Brian, and Brandon. Haley, at the outset, do you feel like any of these three teams look particularly strongest on paper?
I think maybe the first one you mentioned sounds pretty strong, and I'd say maybe the last one is not super strong.
Mm-hmm. Though you never know. I think it's about, you know, to Brooke's point, I think it's about a lot of cohesiveness. I mean, Brooke, you were part of two of the most dramatic restaurant wars in the show's history, between everything with Kristen and Josie, and then in season 14, everything going on with John and Katsuji. It's an opportunity for, even that late in the game, for personal drama to come up. And considering how the last team challenge in this season provided a bit of unintentional drama, I can only imagine when you're in a smaller team and the stakes are higher, you know, what sort of drama might unfold, especially to your point, when you don't really know each other that well and how each other's works. It's going to be literally too many cooks in the kitchen here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see if they have separate kitchens or if they're all kind of working in one large kitchen. That plays a part too. When you're not privy to the dynamics of another team, it's kind of interesting. In our restaurant wars, in both restaurant wars, we couldn't see what was going on with the other team. So we kind of had absolutely no idea where we stood. I think that honestly, the personal dynamics and the teamwork plays such a huge part of Restaurant Wars. So it's impossible for me to predict how any of these teams would do based on what I feel like their level of skill is.
So we shall see next week if the synergy builds up or breaks down to a level of saltiness that surpasses Kevin's cake next week with the first ever three-team restaurant wars in Top Chef history. Brooke, thank you so much for coming on and just giving all the behind-the-scenes tea of the night of a million desserts and the quick fire that came before it. We had such a great time getting to talk with you about this.
Oh, my pleasure, as always. And next time, if you guys decide to have me back ever again, I promise I'll watch LCK. And thank you, guys. It's always so much fun to talk to you instead of talk at you while listening to you.
or scream at us, depending on how wrong we might be about certain things. Well, how can people catch up with you on social media? Is there anything you want to plug in terms of appearances you're doing? It seems like you are all over the map, quite literally, with all the great stuff you're doing lately.
Well, thank you. I mean, nothing specifically that I want to plug in terms of events, but... you know, if you are interested in attending or checking out anything that I'm doing, I am very active on Instagram. And my handle is at Chef Brooke with an E-W. So that's where you can kind of keep up with my entire life. Probably more so than you even want to. So.
That's what social media is about, basically. All of us sort of oversharing facets of our life. And since we're all sort of in it together, I guess it bolsters the community in that way. Haley, Emily, thank you both so much for coming back and delivering great content, as always. Haley, how can people follow you on social media? And do you have a bachelor draft coming up to end the new year and begin another one?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @hstrong_. My blog is strongtakes.ca. There will be a bachelor draft coming out, I'd say within the next, eventually. Amy and I are really lucky this year. The season doesn't start until January 7th, and the cast is already out. Like, usually the last couple of years, they've been like, oh, the season starts January 1st, and we're not going to release the cast until December 29th, so enjoy. So we have a guest lined up for that. I'm excited for you guys to see that and hear that and know that. It'll be eventually, I'd say.
Good. So make sure you turn your podcast to eventually for when Haley comes out with that bachelor draft. Emily, how can people catch up with you to see all of your holiday-based shenanigans that I'm sure will ensue when your two families come together in the next few days?
Oh, totally. There's already a great Instagram story of my dad changing a light fixture for me. So you can follow me at Emlet, which is spelled like omelet, but with an E, both on Twitter and Instagram. And yeah, we will be documenting all sorts of fun stuff, me and Josh. So
I'm excited to watch it. You can always follow me at @MikeBloomType on Twitter. I'm doing exit press for all of the Top Chef boots. I put up my interview with Natalie a few days ago. I actually just got my answers back as we were recording this from Kevin, who was a very, you know, down to earth about, you know, his foibles that he might have undergone over the course of his Top Chef journey. So be sure to check all that out, as well as the RuPaul's Drag Race recaps. I just came out with a holiday special that I did with Rob that was pure insanity, but a lot of fun to do. Plus a bunch of Survivor content, including Exit Press for Parade and the finale for the RHAP B&B as well. So always be tuned in to the stuff that we're all putting out there as we near the end of the year. We'll be back next week to recap the three-team restaurant wars. Any sort of combination of us will shift the boxes around like the quick fire, and we'll see which hosts end up popping up. But I'm having so much fun with this season. Brooke, thank you again so much for coming on. You're an absolute delight. I hope everyone has a merry not May Christmas and a happy holiday. Now you may pack your knives and go.